Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy. This is Dan Nexon. In this podcast, I'll be talking to David B. Coe, who is the award-winning author of 13 novels and the occasional short story. We'll be focusing on his most recent novel, Thief Taker, which is written under the pen name D.B. Jackson. Thief Taker is the first volume of the Thief Taker Chronicles, a series set in pre-revolutionary Boston that combines elements of urban fantasy, mystery, and historical fiction. The second volume, Thieves' Quarry, is currently in production and will be published in 2013. Writing as David B. Coe, he has published The Lon Tobin Chronicle, a trilogy that received the Crawford Fantasy Award as the best work by a new author in fantasy, as well as the critically acclaimed Winds of the Forelands Quintet and Blood of the Southlands trilogy. He has also written the novelization of director Ridley Scott's movie Robin Hood. David's books have been translated into a dozen languages. David is also the co-founder of and a regular contributor to the Magical Words Group blog, a site devoted to discussions of the craft and business of writing fantasy, and he is the co-author of How to Write Magical Words, A Writer's Companion. So this is Dan Nexon, and I'm speaking to David Coe. Hi, David.
Hi, Dan. It's good to be here.
Yeah, and thanks for being on the podcast today. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to be focusing on David's new novel, Thief Taker, which is actually written under a pseudonym, D.B. Jackson. Could we start out maybe, David, with your telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am actually a former academic. I have a PhD in United States history that I earned some 20 years ago at this point, almost. And I hail from the Northeast. I'm living now in the Southeast, where my wife, who is also an academic, teaches biology and works in the administration of her college. And I've been writing fantasy fiction now for about 15 years. My first book came out 15 years ago this past May. And as you say, I've recently kind of come full circle and found a way to blend my old love of history with my passion for writing fantasy. And so that's where Thief Taker came from. I am the father of two teenage daughters who are both beautiful and brilliant and far smarter than their father. That's about it. When I'm not writing, I like to play guitar and shoot pictures with my Canon camera and take hikes and birdwatch and stuff like that.
So you've mentioned, of course, that Thief Taker is a departure in some respects from your earlier work, and you've written a couple of major universes, series of books. Do you want to just give us a brief rundown of those?
Sure. My first trilogy was called the Lon Tobin Chronicle, it was the first book, Children of Amrit, was actually the first piece of fiction that I ever published. And it was set in an imagined world in which magic flowed from a link between mages and avian familiars, usually birds of prey, either hawks or owls, that would perch on their shoulders or help them fight their battles and stuff like that. And it was a story I came up with originally when I was probably 18 or 19 years old, and it sat in the back of my head and percolated and percolated, and I finally got a chance to write it after completing my PhD. When I was done with that, I worked on a 5-book series called The Winds of the Forelands, which is, again, an imagined world, lots of castle intrigue. My wife and I had visited Wales one summer, and we took tours of all these castle ruins, and at the end of that, I was like, I want to write a book about castles. And the next thing I know, I had 5 of them, and the series that followed that up was called Blood of the South Winds, and it was kind of a continuation of Winds of the Forelands. It was set in the same universe, different part of the world, but many of the issues were the same. Those both series kind of revolved around issues of ethnic identity and prejudice and racism and ways in which that affects both kind of human interactions at the meta level, politics, government, and also human interactions at the personal level.
Now, before we move on to Thief Taker, I have to ask about your transition from getting a doctorate in history to becoming a full-time fantasy writer. Mm. So how did that come about?
Well, I went to college thinking I would be a creative writing major and knowing that I loved to write stories and that was my passion. And somewhere along the way in college, I had a couple of bad experiences with writing courses, and my parents kind of tried to impress upon me that writing fiction for a living was really not such a good idea, that it was a tough way to make a living. And after doing this for 15 years, I can tell you that they were absolutely right. So I got away from it. I majored in American studies in college and wrote a thesis on history and politics and really enjoyed that. And I thought, well, maybe I can be a writer and an academic, and that would be a more suitable and more practical use of my passion for writing. And so I went and I started a PhD program. I realized pretty soon into the PhD program that I didn't want to be an academic, that really it was not the same thing as writing fiction, and that level of storytelling didn't appeal to me as much. But I wanted to finish my degree. And upon finishing it, my wife said to me, I think I finished in May, and you know the academic calendar is such that you don't really apply for academic jobs until October or so. And my wife said to me, you know, since the day I met you, you've been talking about writing a novel. You have 5 months. Why not try writing some stories and start working on a book? And so I did. And one thing led to another, and I received a job offer to teach history on a Thursday afternoon. The following morning, I received a call from Tor Books. An editor there wanted to buy my first novel, and I had basically a weekend to decide if I wanted to pursue my academic career or if I wanted to go back to my dream of being a writer. And I chose writing and never really looked back. And as I say, the thing about Thief Taker that has been so nice is I decided for a while, I guess, that writing fantasy meant I couldn't do history anymore, that I had to keep those aspects of my life separate. I'm not sure why I decided that. I'm sure it was an emotional decision made early on. But with Thief Taker, I finally broke down that barrier and said, you know, I can engage my love of history and still follow this career path that I've chosen. And so Thief Taker has really been a very satisfying project for that reason.
So why don't you tell us a bit about the book itself? I mean, I suspect that most of our listeners will have not read it, or at least we should assume that they haven't.
Right.
Hopefully many of them have, and they're tuning in because they really want to hear more about it from you. But why don't you give us the basic background we would need to have an informed conversation about it?
All right, Thief Taker is what I call historical urban fantasy. Historical because it's set in pre-revolutionary Boston on the eve of the American Revolution. And I chose that period because it always fascinated me when I was a graduate student, and also because the other basic concept of the series is that my lead character is a Thief Taker, sort of a 18th century private detective. What makes it fantasy is that he has access to magic. And so the series combines historical fiction, fantasy, the magical element, and mystery, and that's kind of the private investigator urban fantasy element. Each book in the series, as it's planned right now, will be a standalone murder mystery set against the backdrop of some important historical event leading toward the American Revolution. And so book one opens on the night of the Stamp Act riots in August of 1765 with a murder committed on that night. Now, the Stamp Act riots are real. The history that I weave in around the riots, the personalities involved, all of that is as accurate as I could keep it. The murder, of course, is a fiction that I've woven into the historical narrative. And so my character has to investigate this murder, which quickly gets caught up in the politics of the day, but also obviously has a very strong magical element to it. The murder victim was killed by magic, and my character needs to find the person who did it. And that's basically the story.
It's funny. I was trying to think of what I would call this genre when I was explaining it to my wife, who is a fantasy and science fiction reader, and the best we could come up with was magical colonial noir.
So I think that, I like that.
There is a very, or I think we tried tri-cornered noir at one point. There is a very noirish aspect of this novel. I mean, there is a kind of hard-boiled detective amongst various kinds of characters, many of whom are deeply corrupt. Was that a sort of intention, or did that flow from the period in which you set the novel?
No, actually, it was very intentional, and actually the biggest challenge I had in writing the novel was that the noir voice that you refer to, that kind of hard-boiled edge that I tried to give the story, often puts me at odds with the vernacular of the day, which I'm also trying to capture to make my story historically authentic. And so actually I would say that the hardest part about writing this book was matching, on the one hand, the urban fantasy tone I was looking for, that hard-boiled detective novel feel, with something that would strike 21st century readers as at least somewhat authentically historical in the portrayal of Boston in the 1760s and the characters whom my protagonist encounters, who include not only fictional characters, but also people like Samuel Adams and Thomas Hutchinson, who was the British lieutenant governor of the colony at the time, and James Otis, who was another revolutionary figure. And so that was a constant balancing act that I was trying to work on. And it wasn't always easy, but the result, I mean, the fact that you come up with tricorn noir, I love that, and that's that really fits exactly what I was shooting for with the book.
Well, that you've anticipated my next question, but I do want to hear more about it, which is that, you know, one of the fundamental problems whenever you read contemporary historical fiction or historical fantasy or whatever we want to call it, but works that are set in other times, in times that have a very not a kind of diffuse realism, but are located in a specific moment in our own history, is that you have to balance this problem of having characters who both strike readers as authentic to the time, but also are characters they can relate to. And how did you go about trying to get that balance in Thief Taker?
Well, that's a good question. And as I say, that was part of the challenge of writing the book. To a certain degree, I think as an author of historical fiction, I need to find a balance between making concessions to my readers and making concessions to the historical figures who I'm including in my book. So on the one hand, I couldn't have, for instance, Samuel Adams speaking the way Samuel Adams would have spoken in actuality in 1765. You know, you go back to texts at the time and people are spelling words that have twin S's in them, like access, with twin F's instead. So there is a language barrier that kind of crops up immediately as you try to explore these historical issues. And as a writer, that's the first concession we have to make, because we want our 21st century readers to be able to relate to the characters and to be able to relate to the story. On the other hand, I also think that as an author of historical fiction, I owe something to those historical characters with whom I'm working. And I have a responsibility, and I guess this is my academic self talking, but I have a responsibility to be as accurate as possible and to make as few concessions plot-wise to my own narrative needs as I can. I want to be as true to the story as it unfolded in real history as I can. And so in having my character deal with the historical circumstances surrounding those riots that kind of flow through his entire investigation, I was captive to a time frame over which I had no control or very little control, because I was unwilling to compromise in order to accommodate my own plotting needs. And I feel like I'm wandering a little bit from the question you're asking, but I feel as though a writer in my position has to go back and forth and kind of make sacrifices on both ends and ultimately find a way to be as true to history as possible while also not giving up on creating narrative tension and building believable characters and working a plausible setting into the book and doing all those other things as fiction writers that we like to do and need to do to please our readers. Let me pause there and say, ask you if I've mangled the question or if you think I'm on the right track here.
Well, actually, you've opened up new avenues that I'd like to explore, so even better than handling it or getting it right. So one of the things that struck me, I think we may wind up coming back to some of these issues when we get a little bit further into the meat of the book, but so you talked in terms of being true to the historical record, both in terms of being true to characters, social context, etc., but also in terms of being true to the timeline, right? You didn't want to invent events that would disrupt the unfolding of 18th century Boston history. But that raises a kind of other question, which is that you've introduced a world, or you've introduced into our historical flow the ability to cast spells, right? To conjure up spells, many of which are quite powerful in their implications. And to any reader who's concerned whether you have a background in alternate history, or whether you're somebody like me who does work on historical case studies and is concerned about contingency issues, you know, whether or not events had to be the way they were, whether or not slight changes could have altered them, one does have to wonder how in a world with conjuration we would have gotten to roughly the same place that we are in circa mid to late 18th century.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and that's an interesting question, and it's one, I mean, I think the continuity question is one, frankly, that becomes so large that I'm not sure that someone writing historical fantasy is equipped to deal with it. I mean, it comes back to that moment in Ray Bradbury's A Sound of Thunder when the moth shows up, stuck in the guy's shoe, and he finds that the English language has been transformed because he killed the wrong moth at the wrong time in the course of history. Do you know the reference I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So I think you could safely say that what you're bringing up is an issue that I have neglected entirely. That, yes, if conjuring really exists in the alternate Boston that I have created, then my Boston really shouldn't bear any resemblance to the Boston that we wound up with, because the continuity issues going back time immemorial to whenever conjuring first became viable would have changed the course of history. And who knows whether the British would have ended up in North America? Who knows whether they would have taken control of the Eastern Seaboard, or if the Dutch would have managed to do it, or somebody else? So, to a certain degree, I'm going to beg the question. But then I come to what I can do as a historical fiction writer without going back and writing off, creating alternate worlds again. And that is, I tried to create a magical system that blended with historical circumstances as we know them. And so my conjurers, people like my lead character who can cast spells, my conjurers are constantly dealing with fears of witchcraft and trying to reconcile their own abilities with the superstitions that were rife in society, and in particular in religious society at the time. And so the way I camouflage this historical conceit of adding magic to the mix is I blend it with the Salem witch trials, with continued fear of witches as it developed through the 18th century, and try to make my magic seem as much a part of the landscape as anything else that my readers would encounter were they to go back to the 18th century Boston that we know.
See, that's the... I'm sorry, go on.
Let me just say that we should also talk about thief-taking, because as it happens, there really were no thief-takers in Boston, mm-hmm. historically speaking. But I use history the same way, but we can get to that in a minute. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say that was the answer I was kind of hoping for, because one of the things that I found really impressive about the way that you wove magic into the milieu was precisely how the rarity of magic, the degree to which it is repressed and suppressed by the authorities and by religious institutions and secular authorities, if that's a reasonable distinction in the period, and also the kinds of things that magic seems to be used for in this world would make it fairly easy to retell a lot of European history where simply the things that people accused one another of doing to produce outcomes were in fact the things that they were doing.
Right.
But that sort of raises questions about where you intend the magic system and the magic, the sort of magic powers that you have in the novels to go over the sequence of them. It seems fairly, I mean, I don't know, as a reader, I expect that a big part of the meta mystery of the novels is in fact learning more about the conjuration system and who Uncle Reg is, the ghost that appears whenever Ethan conjures and that sort of thing. Is that
right? And I think that certainly in the second book, and so far I've only written the second book, the magic. Well, let me backtrack a little bit. I'm a firm believer in, when I write fantasy novels, that magic needs to have consistent rules and limitations and costs, and it needs to be something that remains the same and does not expand or contract as the author's narrative exigencies might demand. So once I establish the rules of a magic system, I really need to stick to those rules across volumes as well as within a single book. But that said, in the second book, Ethan discovers things about his own powers that he hadn't known before. And he also is able to make better use of Uncle Reg as an ally in the work he does. And Reg's role in the second book is far greater than his role in the first book. And that was something that I wanted to do and that I plan to develop further as the series continues.
So we've talked about the problem of, you know, magical counterfactualism, as it were, right? You know, but I also want to come back to some other issues of credibility, authenticity, and also, while not losing reader engagement. One of the things that I think is particularly difficult for authors writing this idiom to deal with are, given the nature of the contemporary audience, are issues surrounding the status of women. You know, and particularly this is in Thief Taker, you go out of your way to make sure that we have some strong, well-developed, but different, you know, not all burly strong, you know, sword wielding, what have you, but, you know, strong, right. That is, in well-rounded and thoughtful female characters. And I noticed that a number of those characters are widows. And my vague recollection is that in English common law and in English legal institutions, that being a widow did in fact afford you a fair amount of freedom to self-actualize in a way that women didn't normally have. And is that right? And is that a deliberate move on your behalf in order to provide us with some characters who can have the kind of social freedoms that we might not associate with the period?
Yes, it's absolutely true, and it's something that I did deliberately. Certainly with the character of Canice, who is Ethan's girlfriend, for lack of a better word, talk about using a non-18th century term. But there, once a woman was married and lost her husband, which was fairly common. I mean, you know, mortality rates in this time from diseases, be it from pleurisy or smallpox or what they call distemper, all these things, they happened with some frequency. Plus, there were wars being fought in the 1750s and into the 1760s. And so widows were fairly common in colonial America. And as you say, once they had been married and lost their husbands, they had far more freedom to express themselves economically and to kind of take advantage of the freedom that came from being, for instance, a business owner if they inherited their husband's business, or from being independently wealthy if they were just left large amounts of money. And so I wanted to take advantage of that because I didn't want to write necessarily female characters who were entirely beholden to their spouses. Now, that said, I think it's very easy for us, looking back and kind of taking a kind of cursory historical gloss on the period, to overestimate the degree to which the lives of women were circumscribed by custom and society in the period in which I'm writing. Women had more freedom than is generally acknowledged, because, again, in order to get at that freedom, in order to understand the more complex gender dynamics at the time, you really need to delve much deeper into the history. One of the professors I worked with when I was getting my degree wrote a book about sexual mores during the course of American history. And one of the things he points out is that in 18th century America, young couples were far more sexually active and far more engaged in that way than we would generally acknowledge given what we think we know about the period. And so to a certain degree, I was using widows as a way of giving my female characters more chances at agency and self-actualization. But also I was drawing upon the fact that women at the time just had more freedom than we might think.
So one of the things that you mention in your, I think it's your afterword, is that this story was not originally set in an historical imaginary, right? But was set in a more typical fantasy world.
Right.
It's interesting because, I mean, I think it's a sign of how well constructed it is that I have a lot of difficulty imagining the story taking place anywhere other than in, if not colonial America, at least in, you know, Enlightenment Europe and its colonies. So could you mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about what was involved in that transition and why this wound up being going from being, I guess, pure quote-unquote fantasy to historical fiction with a fantastic element?
Well, I made the transition, quite frankly, at the urging of my editor, who ever since we've been working together, and he and I, he's been my editor for every book I've ever written. He's wanted me to go back to my historical background and take advantage of it because he enjoys history and he enjoys historical fiction. The idea for Thief Taker originally came from a footnote in a history book about Australia that I had been reading. The book is called The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes. And my wife and I were getting ready to go live for a year in Australia. She was going to be on sabbatical from her academic position. And so we were reading this book. And in reading a history of Australia, which, because Australia began as a British penal colony, would have touched on British law enforcement history, the author of the book wrote this long discursive footnote about a thief taker named Jonathan Wild. Jonathan Wild built a criminal empire for himself by basically having men in his employ steal things, give them to him so that he could sell the most valuable and then turn around and return the rest to its rightful owner for a fee. So basically, he was a thief taker who was creating his own business by having his employees steal on his behalf. And so he was the inspiration for the main antagonist to my lead character. And when I told my editor, here's where the story came from, he immediately said, well, why did you write it as a fantasy then? Why not write it as a historical fantasy and do all the things you want to do with the story, but set it in a real-world setting and use real-world thief takers and stuff like that? So that was what I ended up doing, because I began to see the sense in his argument, and he originally wanted me to set it in England, and I didn't want to do that, but that's when I came up with the idea for setting it in colonial America, and all of a sudden I was able to imagine writing a book that was drawing upon my historical background, and the appeal was very great. It was a hard thing to do because I loved the world I had created for the original Thief Taker. And someday I hope to go back to it and write some different stories in that world. But I had to adjust my narrative to match historical circumstance. And so I started searching through colonial history for a period and for a set of events that would work well with the story as I had written it. And when I found the Stamp Act riots and kind of remembered the history of them and started exploring it more deeply, I realized that the story lent itself to that historical circumstance far better than I ever could have imagined. It was a perfect fit, and I was able to just kind of slot everything in just the way I wanted to, and perhaps inadvertently I had written a story in the imaginary world that followed some form of American history. But whatever the reason, the stories work together. And the second book works even better. And I had already started the second book as an alternate world fantasy as well, and was able to make that transition just as easily.
One of the things I enjoyed about Thief Taker, and I don't know where you intend to go with these themes, but is that you give us an opportunity, particularly us meaning American readers, to get some insight into why the revolutionary position is not necessarily the obvious one, and why the loyalist position is both one that's emotively powerful for many people and also, has a logic behind it. So it serves that kind of purpose, I think, of helping to demystify something of our own history. Is that something you intend to pursue at greater length? It certainly seems by the end of the novel you're set up for a running debate over the merits of separation.
Yeah, I think that it's something I want to pursue. I wanted Ethan, my lead character, to a certain degree, I wanted him to be a character who my readers would like, but also find challenging to them. And so there are lots of things about him. The fact that he is he's lame, he has an injury from when he was an ex-convict, another thing about him that readers might not respond to well at first. But he was a convict, he was on a labor plantation for a while, he lost part of his foot to gangrene, and so he's an older character, and he's scarred, and he's imperfect, and he's a Tory. He's a supporter of the British Empire, and as I say, I was looking for ways in which I would be challenging my readers, even as they came to know and like my lead character. But I also wanted to be able to engage in some discussion of the political issues of the day, and his being a Tory allowed me to do that, and allowed me to introduce Samuel Adams, who my readers are going to be predisposed to like because of who he is and what he represents, and have this historical icon be at odds with the character who they're supposed to like and be sympathetic to. And I think all of these things help to deepen the story and deepen my readers' engagement with the story. By the same token, I think you can also see by the end of this book, and certainly it continues in the second book, that Ethan's thinking on the question of rebellion and separation from England is evolving, and it continues to evolve, and that evolution accelerates in the second book, which coincides with the occupation of Boston by British troops in 1768. And so I want to continue the discussion, but I also want to eventually move Ethan over to the side of the angels, as it were. I should also say that while I appreciate what you said about it, and I feel that it was a good decision, I've taken some heat for it from some readers in Amazon reviews and other places who find Ethan's loyalties not being with the rebel cause disturbing, and they don't like it. They're uncomfortable with it, which actually surprised me that they would, of all things in the book, there's lots for people to be uncomfortable with, that they should latch onto that. I found it very surprising.
I wish I had something profound to say about that, but I guess you've written a book about ethnicity and nationalism in an imaginary world, so it shouldn't be surprising if you experience some blowback on by touching one of the holy grails of American nationalist discourse.
Right. So
I really did very much enjoy this book, but
thank you.
But I was concerned that Ethan struck me as not necessarily the brightest bulb on the planet at times. and there are times in which I wonder if a smarter thief taker might have picked up on the hints and the clues that you drop a little more quickly. Is that a deliberate move by you, or how do you think about his detecting process, his thinking process about as he discovers, unravels the mystery?
I think that a character like Ethan can only be as smart as the author who created him, and I think that in this case, what you see is probably more an author who is writing full-scale mystery for the first time, who wasn't as light-handed as he should have been in dropping clues, than it is any intentional denseness on my character's part. I mean, as I say, Ethan is an imperfect character, as any character ought to be, and I'm sure, and I do know that there were times when I wanted him to be somewhat obtuse, because sometimes it's fun for your reader to have information that your character doesn't yet have, and to be saying, what is he going to figure this out? Is he going to get it? But there are other times I think that I just, I'm not a perfect writer yet, and can't imagine that I ever will be. I've yet to meet one, and I think that what you're picking up on is probably more to do with my own creative process than anything I intended to do with Ethan as a character.
Well, I will say, to walk that back a little bit, my understanding of mystery writing, which is very limited, is that, but nonetheless, what I understand is that one of the most difficult decisions to make is not only how much to drop to the reader so that the reader can figure out autonomously what's going on, but also when to make that pivot from we don't know what's going on to, oh my God, when is the protagonist going to figure out what's going on, because not doing so puts him or her in jeopardy. And, so I think you can make a plausible case that the decisions you make on that are fairly good ones. I will say also that you include probably the only example of an evil overlord explanation, which is narratively plausible. So when we actually come to every mystery that I've ever read that's embedded in another genre, let alone mysteries that are within the mystery genre, always has that kind of confessional speech in it at some point. And the one that occurs in Thief Taker is completely justified within the sequence of action, right? It doesn't cost the antagonist anything to make it, and his motivation for having made it also makes sense. So I wanted to applaud you for that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I have to say that I've taken a little bit of abuse for that in reviews. I mean, I should say the reviews for my book have been overwhelmingly generous, and I'm very happy with them. And even on Amazon, where you have no control whatsoever over what's going to happen to your book, I've been very fortunate to get a lot of very good reviews and very few poor ones. But the few criticisms I have gotten, one of them has focused again and again on that speech at the end, and that, oh, look, he resorted to that. Can't we have a mystery that doesn't resort to that? And looking back on it, I wish I had found another way to convey the information. But the truth is, if in writing a mystery, you create an effective nemesis for your investigative character, too much of his plotting would go unseen by the reader if you didn't have that sort of confessional at the end. And so the reason it's a trope in the mystery field is that there are just so many ways to explain everything that's happened. And just as my readers objected to the fact that some of my readers objected to the fact that I put this kind of a speech in there, I would have been savaged in reviews had I not put it in there, because they would have been coming and saying, well, how did he do this? And why did he do that? And, you know, how do you explain away this? So it's one of these damned if you do, damned if you don't aspects of writing mystery. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it sounds like there's no way to win for someone for an author who is well-read and has a loyal group of readers. Which does raise a broader question. I mean, one of the things that so in preparation for this interview, I was poking around on your website and on the multiple kind of blogs and online presences that you maintain, you know, which is pretty common now for anybody in the business. But I was particularly impressed because you run you are involved in a collaborative website called MagicalWorlds.net. Did I get the URL correct?
It's actually Magical Words, W-O-R-D-S.
Fell for the pun in remembering it, right? So magicalwords.net, which is really intended to help to build kind of community, both with people who are published writers, but also with people who are trying to get into the business or at various stages of the business. And I thought that was really interesting. What drove you to kind of really engage in that kind of community building activity?
Well, it came out of a stint I did as an instructor at the South Carolina Writers Workshop annual convention. This was back in 2007. I've now been an instructor for the South Carolina Workshop on three different occasions, and love teaching writing, and I do teaching in other venues as well, and currently engaged as a mentor to a student at another university, and I really enjoy teaching writing, and I you hear people talking about, you know, kind of giving back to the industry that gave them their start, and I really believe in that, and I was helped out by some established professionals when I first started writing, and wanted to be able to do the same for aspiring writers and writers who were just starting out in their careers. But the story of the site is that while I was at this convention, at this writers' conference teaching, I was introduced by my agent to another of her writers who was also there teaching at the conference. Her name is Faith Hunter. She writes the Jane Yellow Rock urban fantasy series, and has also written several other series and has written under various pseudonyms. She is a longtime professional and just a wonderful person, and is similarly interested in teaching and devoting herself to giving back to the industry. And she and I hit it off. It was like meeting another sibling, one I'd never known I had, and we spent the evening chatting and laughing and talking about our experiences during the conference teaching students, and we decided that we wanted to collaborate on some project, and we came up with the idea of a blog site that would be devoted to the type of teaching we had just done for the weekend. And we engaged a couple of other authors to join us as we were starting out, and launched Magical Words in January of 2008. And at this point, you know, we've been going for 4.5 years. We have a huge following. We have at least a dozen different writers involved, either on a regular basis or on a kind of a semi-regular guest appearance basis. We have a book out called How to Write Magical Words, A Writer's Companion. It has become this thing that is so far beyond what we ever imagined it would be. And yet we still enjoy it, and we still are gaining new readership every month, and it's been great.
So one of the things you've talked about recently, which was of particular interest to me because it, as you begin your discussion of it, has a resonance with the experience not just of being a fiction writer, but also being a nonfiction writer, or social sciences, the humanities, or the natural sciences, is this problem of kind of scooping and, you know, of what do you do when you discover that your great idea, your great hook, has already been published?
Right.
I thought you might elaborate a little bit on that, and I wanted to ask you a couple questions.
Sure. It grew out of, I was doing a series of posts on ideas and where ideas come from and what writers do with them once they find them and how we go about turning an idea into a published novel and the difficulties and processes involved in doing that. And one of the things I found again and again from our readership in their comments to my first two posts in the series was this kind of common underlying fear that all of them had. What if somebody steals your idea? Or if not steals, what if you find out that you have this great idea, but somebody else has already written it or is about to come out with it? What do you do? And so I devoted the post that you're speaking of, which is this week's post, to that topic. And what it came down to for me was something that I was told by my advisor in graduate school when I was still writing history, and I was worried as a aspiring historian of I was worried about having my dissertation idea scooped from me, taken from me by a more established professional. And what he said to me, and it really did resonate, was he said, if you're thinking that your dissertation idea can be scooped in that way, you're thinking too narrowly about your topic. And I think what he meant was we bring to the work we do, be it fictional or non-fictional, artistic or scholarly, a host of human experience, of emotion, of idiosyncratic approaches to knowledge and wordplay and everything else that inform everything we do. And that is as much a part of the writing and the research and everything else as that original spark of inspiration that led us to the idea. And what he was basically saying to me was, ideas are great, but the devil is in the execution. It's in what you do with the idea and how you make it into something that is going to be utterly original, because five different scholars could look at the material you're looking at and write completely different dissertations. And the same is true with fiction. Five different writers could be given an idea for writing about thief takers in colonial America, and you know, I'm the only one who's going to come up with Thief Taker, the book that you have in your hands. And those other four are going to come up with something similar in conception, but entirely different in execution. And so that was the point of the essay, and I was hoping that I was going to put to rest some of these concerns that our aspiring readership has over at the site.
I think there's also, though, another issue lurking behind that, which I don't... So in the speculative fiction, one of the things that people often talk about in the speculative fiction or the science fiction genre is the degree to, you know, sort of the density of the intertext, right? The density of the dialogue between works. And given that the genre has existed in more or less its contemporary form for, you know, decades, if not a century, that density is pretty darn thick. And it can make it very difficult for people who are very smart and creative, but trying to kind of break into it to figure out how they can slot in, right? Or what makes for an idea that's good enough to slot into it.
Right.
And I think that's particularly exacerbated in some ways by, you know, the critical industry that's grown up around the genre. Now, I'm actually ashamed to say that I'm less familiar with contemporary fantasy. One of the reasons I agreed to do this gig was to force me to read more of it. But to what degree is that operating in fantasy now? I know that the last time I was a serious consumer of newly written fantasy was maybe 20 years ago, and I've gotten up to speed now, but there's just been a proliferation of genres and subgenres, right, within fantasy.
Yes, there has, and I think that's made it easier on aspiring writers in a way. In other ways, this is a much more difficult market than the market I broke into 15, 20 years ago. There are fewer venues, there are more authors competing for shelf space. There's less shelf space. It's a much harder market. But in terms of the idea marketplace. I think the proliferation of subgenres, and in particular the growth of urban fantasy, the growth of YA markets, so that there's a niche now for authors who are looking to write for younger writers and who are writing about anything from wizards to zombies to vampires to werewolves to post-apocalyptic America, whatever your choice. There are so many more marketing ideas out there, marketing slots that people can fit an idea into. And I think that the proliferation of genres has made it so that you have, at this point, this cornucopia of terrific fantasy ideas. I remember the first time I read an urban fantasy. I can't remember which title it was. I think it might have been one of Jim Butcher's Harry Dresden books.
If or I else could it just was Rachel. Interrupt you for a second. Our listeners may not actually know what urban fantasy is, so maybe you could give us a potted description.
That's a tough one. Urban fantasy is essentially books written, for the most part, and this is one of the things that sets Peacetaker apart, but for the most part, urban fantasies are contemporary, real-world settings. So, say they're set in New York City or in Boston or in Chicago or something like that. They tend to have a mystery element, and they tend to have a strong magical or paranormal element. So there might be conjuring involved, wizards doing spells and stuff like that, or there may be the involvement of, as I say, werewolves and vampires or demons of some sort, and usually you have a first-person or close third-person narrator, single point of view, who is trying to solve a mystery or fight the demons or the vampires, and it's kind of that person's story with a somewhat noir voice, but a very strong magical element. Do you think that pretty much covers it?
I'm sure you can define it better than I can. As I copped to earlier, back when I was reading fantasy, those novels exist, but they weren't called anything.
Right. But what I was going to say is I still remember reading my first book that fell into this sort of subgenre and being blown away by the originality of it. And as I say, I think it might have been Jim Butcher is a very successful urban fantasy author who has a series out called The Harry Dresden Files that are basically he's a private investigator, a wizard who operates in Chicago and solves mysteries and fights, vampires and werewolves and stuff like that. It was revelatory, and I remember reading it and thinking, I want to write more of this. I want to read more of this, and I want to write this. This is fun stuff. And you have what's called steampunk, which is kind of, again, it's a kind of a blend of fantasy and science fiction that takes unusual technologies and inserts it into late 19th and early 20th century venues, or even earlier than that sometimes, that have no business having the types of technologies they have. But this steampunk was kind of a big thing 10 or 12 years ago, and it's still hanging on, but that's when it's got its start. And again, it's different. It's kind of funky to read. The stuff you encounter in it is utterly unexpected, and yet the stories hold together beautifully and have this incredibly magical feel to them. So there's tons of possibilities now that makes it easier for people with uncommon ideas to find ways to express themselves.
So this gets at what you sort of, I think, mentioned both in your original blog post and then some of the commentary you have in, or some of your contributions to the comments thread, which is that the increased number of genres, or the increased number of, oh, this work is like that kind of work, right? The increased number of works that, I am not articulating myself very well, but the very fact that there are works that do things that are similar is actually a positive from a marketing perspective. Right.
It is, and especially, I mean, right now the publishing industry, and we could talk about the publishing industry for hours and not exhaust the topic right now. But the publishing industry right now, obviously, is going through huge upheavals and technological changes, and publishers are a little more timid than they were maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And so while they are exploring these new genres, they're doing so in a very kind of dip-your-toe-in-the-water way. And to the degree to which an editor can go to his publishing hierarchy and say, this is just like Harry Dresden, but with a historical angle, and it's set in colonial Boston. And that's pretty much how we pitched Thief Taker when it was finally written. It was Harry Dresden, that character from Jim Butcher's book. Harry Dresden meets Samuel Adams. That was a terrific pitch because it told them where it fit in the market, and it also told them what was new about it, the ways in which it drew upon existing marketing trends, and yet also did something a little bit different. And because publishers are being a little more cautious, that it's like this, but it does this approach to marketing, both for an editor pitching to his higher-ups, or an agent pitching to an editor, or an author pitching to an agent, that helps us fit our work into the larger commercial structure, but also establish what makes it different and appealing. In today's marketplace, that seems to be working very well.
Well, it certainly seems to have worked well for Thief Taker, which I want to stress as we close down, that this is a really fun and interesting book. I'm sort of a sucker for historical settings with fantastic elements, so it definitely appealed to me, but I think our listeners will really enjoy it, and it certainly promises, I think, to be a really engaging, interesting series over its entire arc. So thanks for coming on and for talking about it with us.
Dan, I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity. It's been fun talking to you.
All right. So long.
Bye-bye. Bye.
This episode of New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy was recorded 14 August 2012 and featured David B. Coe.